Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Alex Housen, and this is Write Medicine, a weekly podcast that explores best practices in creating content that connects with and educates health professionals. I'm a former nurse and an academic who spent the last 16 years as an independent medical writer and researcher, creating and evaluating education content for health professionals. If your work involves planning, designing, delivering, or evaluating education for health professionals, this podcast is for you. This episode of Write Medicine is brought to you by Write CME Pro, a membership-driven community that provides skills, scaffolding, and support for medical writers who want to create CME content with confidence. Write CME Pro gives you access to expert perspectives to help you build your CME writing skills, a portfolio accelerator to hold space so that you can create stunning samples to show your prospects, group coaching to help you build foundational and expert knowledge in CME, and more. Write CME Pro is a community for people like you who are ready to grow their CME writing niche, or niche, if that's how you say it. See the show notes for more details. In this episode of Write Medicine, Eugene Pozniak takes us on a tour of the European continuing medical education environment. Eugene is managing director and CEO of CME Learning, the only organization accredited on both sides of the Atlantic by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education and the European Board of Accreditation of Continuing Education for Health Professionals. That's a lot of words. Eugene describes a disparate European CME landscape, driven by national requirements and split by specialties within countries. We explore the similarities and differences in approach to accreditation between the European and US contexts, and we talk about the European CME Forum, co-founded by Eugene alongside Peter Llewellyn in 2008. Join us. Welcome, Eugene.
Hi, Alex.
It's good to see you.
No, it's great to be here. Thanks very much for the invitation.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've, you know, wanted to have this conversation with you for a long time, and I know we're on very different time zones. So it's good that we're able to connect up here. And I should explain for listeners that you're in Belgium, right?
Actually, I'm in the UK.
You're in the
I'm in Manchester, UK. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to let you talk about that. You're a man who wears many hats. So please share something with listeners who you are and a little bit about what you currently do.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there are two main hats that I wear. The first one is as managing director and CEO of CME Learning. We are an education company. We're based in the UK. We've always been here. And I started it 16, 17 years ago as a single-handed consultancy. But over the years, we have evolved into a fully-fledged, accredited education provider. We're accredited by the ACCME. We were the first organization outside of the US to achieve this.
Oh,
so
wow.
That was back in 2015. We went through all of that, and really as a demonstration, and it was around the time that accreditation standards were starting to sort of overlap with each other. So that was an interesting move for us. And in fact, just this year, we've also been accredited by EBAC as well, the European Board of Accreditation of Continuing Education for Health Professionals. So now we're the only organization to be accredited on both sides of the Atlantic.
Wow.
So we run that. We're only a small company. We do a lot of work in joint providership.
Mm-hmm.
We do a couple of our own projects, but we're there really trying to promote and foster that sort of accredited CME internationally. Yeah, so we work globally. Rewinding a little bit, you know, when I first started up CME Learning, there really wasn't that much actual CME continuing medical education going on. And there was a lot of discussion. We had people working in their silos, the different groups, the accreditors, the medical societies, providers, industry as well. And I was sitting with a colleague one day, and we created the European CME Forum. So we founded that's now in its 16th year.
Oh, wow.
Where we bring together anyone with an interest in CME, European or global CME, really, yeah, we've got the annual meeting. So the person I set it up with, Peter Llewellyn, was, yeah, I think he's quite well known to probably quite a few of your listeners, and especially people who do work in the promotional side, you know, the medical communication side of the business. But it was a few years in that he left because accredited CME really is a non-promotional activity, and it was really a clash of interests for him. So it's sad to see him go, but we've continued growing as that. So I sort of, my working day revolves around either wearing one hat as an accredited provider or as someone trying to bring together the CME community.
That's amazing. And I didn't realize that connection with Peter. He's been around for a very long time. And I came across Peter, probably about 16 years ago, because he was one of the few people that seemed to be kind of, certainly in the US, sharing information about what medical writing looked like generally. And when I was kind of transitioning from academia into medical writing, some of the resources that he shared were the main places where I got information about what was possible, and eventually sort of found my way to accredited CME, which is kind of a sweet spot. So it's nice to know that you have that connection as well. And I'm not quite sure why I thought you were in Belgium. So I think that's something to do with it being early-ish here where I am.
I'm just 1 hour closer to you.
Yeah.
But actually, officially, I'm also in the Netherlands. I am in the Low Countries, yes. So that's probably what you're thinking of. Because after 2016 and the glories of Brexit and the opportunities it brought to British companies, a lot of British companies left the UK, and including myself. So European CME Forum is actually now a Dutch organization. It's set up as a not-for-profit educational foundation in the Netherlands. And also CME Learning, we have a Dutch office there as well. And this is for compliance reasons, transparency, holding databases, etc., because the UK has left the European Union. So, yeah, we'll possibly talk about this a bit later on as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But,
equally Dutch, yeah.
Yeah, and I think I remembered the Netherlands, but then misremembered it as Belgium, not the Netherlands. So how did you actually find your way into CME? I mean, what's your professional background?
So, yeah, CME, it was, I think like many people, I just fell into it by accident. I started off as a scientist working for pharma.
Oh, okay.
Going through the sales and marketing functions. I spent most of my time working in medical advertising and medical communications as well. And it was, that's when I first met Peter, actually, was while I was moving jobs within the medcoms industry. I was the first person to get a job through his job board.
Right. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, he had an online job board, and there was a free advertisement he did for a colleague of his, a friend from his university days, who ended up being my boss as well. So we sort of stayed in touch after that. And I was just looking for another job at that time, and I happened to have a conversation with someone who was active in CME. I did something back in 96 at the beginning of evidence-based medicine and an actual accredited CME activity in the UK. And I thought, well, actually, yeah, this will be interesting. Let's see how it goes. I was doing a lot of stuff online, internet technology, and this new outfit we had, I mean, he was there, looked after the content side of things, but I actually looked after the online implementation first.
Ah, right. Okay.
And so I was just doing that and watching and observing the CME world around me, and was quickly drawn into that. I mean, there's a lot of excitement very fast in that early sort of year 2000.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, 96 is probably, maybe a little bit earlier, is probably when continuing professional development came onto my radar. At the time I was still an academic in Scotland, and there was, at the University of Edinburgh, I think there was a department of continuing professional development in general practice, something like that. I'm misremembering that as well. But they were actually one of the kind of early departments that did a lot of academic research into CPD and specifically continuing professional development versus CME. And we might talk about the differences there. So it sounds like mid-90s was a time when there was a lot of change, a lot of evolution in the UK. You've mentioned Brexit a couple of times. So What impact has that made, or just in general, you know, how would you describe the CME landscape in Europe generally and separately in the UK?
Yeah, sure. I think Brexit maybe typifies what the CME landscape is like in Europe. It's very nationally driven. The individual countries have their own systems, and it's also split by specialty within the countries. And a lot of people working in international and global CME are aware of the pan-European accreditation systems like EBAC or the UEMS, you know, through EACME, the European Accreditation Council of CME. So, and maybe through the medical societies, but then it's more sort of specialty-led. But the actual implementation, much like it would be in the US, it's done on a national or a state level, a regulatory obligation of the individual healthcare professional. And in Europe, that's driven by national requirements. So each country really has its own system, and they're very disparate at times. So yeah, Brexit doesn't really highlight that. From a medical perspective, it's caused problems, of course, because the whole point of the European Union is the free movement of people, trade, and goods across borders. So there is no free movement of medical professionals from Europe to come to the UK to work here. It's pretty difficult. I mean, even to get a visa to visit as a tourist is not that easy now because we are a third country. It's just like, you know, a US or a Canadian person trying to work with people from the European Union. Mm-hmm. But probably the biggest direct consequence of Brexit as an education provider is management of data and databases and financial compliance. Yeah, because there is that bubble within the European Union of mutually recognized accountancy practices, banking practices, which a lot of, especially pharma companies, work under these principles. And when they're looking at the UK now it's a third country, so it's a different consideration. It's not that sort of European-wide approach that's so convenient that, quite frankly, we're missing now.
Right. Yeah. No, that does sound tricky. You talked about the disparate kind of models of disparate approaches or disparate delivery of education in different European countries. It seems that there's been a discussion or a debate about harmonization for a long time. Is that something that's on the horizon?
Yeah. So in those early days, in the early 2000s, so CME in Europe, you've already mentioned, yeah, the UK really was at the forefront of CME. Of course, it was called CPD then. Yeah, the mid-90s, we had the system that you mentioned. Yeah, of course, Scotland has a slightly different system to England and Wales because it was split like that. But yeah, the first, it sort of started in the UK and then in the Netherlands. But by about 1999, 2000, then the medical societies took this on board and a load of standard operating procedures, the CME standards evolved there. And they were all much of a muchness across the countries, across the medical societies. But it was always missing that sort of mutual recognition or kind of piece. And there's a lot of discussion about harmonization of CME internationally across Europe. And that was quite a buzzword for about 10, 12 years or so. And then it faded out. See, nowadays, people don't use that word because it didn't really happen. Mm. You know, people either accept credits from that other authority or not. But most recently, actually on the accreditor's side, we have seen a move from a slightly different angle from the International Academy of CPD Accreditors. So this is a group of individuals who work in accreditation bodies. And it's not just in Europe, but they're globally. You know, the US are involved, as in through the ACCME, the Royal College in Canada, South Africa, you know, Latin America, Southeast Asia, et cetera, countries, as well as some in Europe. And they are probably, this is the most promising sign of some kind of harmonization of CME approaches, CME accreditation standards, etc. Yeah, so I think that's what we're seeing recently.
Oh, that's interesting. And you've mentioned ACCME a couple of times. What do you see as the main similarities and differences in approaches to accreditation in a European context compared to the US context?
Yeah. So, I mean, the ACCME system is a provider accreditation-based system. And it's very mature. I mean, it's been running for decades now with some growing pains, and you know, but it's ended up in a very mature system that the whole world looks at in some way. I'm sure many accreditors around the world are copy and pasting certain ideas that have already been discussed, debated, and agreed on, and they are seen as the gold standard. From a European perspective, I mean, straight off, I'd say all European countries accept the AMA credit. So once that comes in, so ironically, you know, the AMA credit is recognized in more European countries than any European credit.
That's interesting.
The agreements aren't in place. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
No, and sometimes it's just, yeah, the Europeans, they like to define things to a granular level. You know, we will accredit 1 hour of 1 hour of educational activity, but not 45 minutes. You know, you're on your own then. Or some, you know, we have this accreditation on micro learning, and smaller packages can be packaged as full integer credits, you know, that full value. But we're not very good with the fractions of credits in Europe. So if you can't do your fractions, then, you know, how is it implemented? So we have these great conversations, you know, while the accreditation bodies are trying to define what is accreditable, whereas the ACCME system, with to give AMA credit, it's as a European looking at that system, as a European working within that environment, even though some people might say, oh, this is really strict and the standards are very difficult to meet, etc., there is actually this breath of freedom where you say, well, as long as it is deliberately engaged education, there is some way of certifying it for credit. And it can really, you know, you can open your mind and think outside the box, be really imaginative with the planning and implementation of educational activities. So that's actually a lovely thing. Whereas in Europe, yeah, they'll be looking, some accreditation bodies will first be looking at, you know, what is the format? Does that comply with our rules that we came up here with in 2001 or something?
Right.
You know, pre-internet days as well. And so there's a problem, yeah, with novel technologies and things for the accreditors to actually recognize that. And so sometimes the education becomes a secondary thought to the accredited CME in Europe.
The compliance issues. And I was going to ask you, what are the implications of that for the format and the structure and the type of education that you can actually deliver? For instance, you mentioned micro-learning, so, and those smaller chunks of education. But it sounds as though you don't quite have some of the freedom that providers might have in the US to experiment, to innovate, that's an overused word, but to try different things in the education space, because technology is always evolving. And of course, in the last 3 years, it's really accelerated. There's lots of different types of interactive tools available now for online education. So I'm just kind of wondering how much freedom there is to experiment a little bit in the types of education formats you're able to deliver.
Yeah, and that is a drawback of the activity-based accreditation system, right, is that you have to define the activity. So yeah, as you say, since the pandemic, the way that learners are consuming education has radically changed right across the board, from learner recruitment, engagement of faculty, how it's promoted, how it's absorbed, what the learners expect. Even from a writing perspective, you know, the way people are expecting the information to be presented on the screen has changed radically. And this is not even thinking about any kind of new funky formats that might have come out in the meantime. Meanwhile, the ACCME AMA is saying, that's fine, be imaginative, go for whatever you want. We as providers then, we're interested in our own success. So of course, we're analyzing how we are performing against whatever measures we're using, and we can respond to the learner's own responses and adapt flexibly our own education to meet their needs. Mm-hmm. Whereas, with an activity-based accreditation system, that's quite tough. If someone's saying, no, it must be at least 15 minutes long, and then you're having to negotiate with the accreditation body saying, well, you know, if we do X, Y, Z in a certain way, is that okay? We're spending weeks and months sometimes trying to negotiate a new format. And if you have to wait 6 months for something, time flies. Yeah, so that's a drawback. But I'm trying to think of some sort of positives. But I think actually in Europe, they're realizing that the accreditors are realizing they need to be more flexible, actually look to serving the needs of the education providers and their own learners, that their own rules, literally written over 20 years ago, many of them, are not current today in the internet post-pandemic age. And they are getting more flexible. So especially, I mean, EBAC now, this us being accredited by them as an accredited provider, this is quite, this is unique in Europe.
Yeah.
They've recognized that accrediting providers really is the way to go forward. And we do have flexibility with formats. EACME is apparently launching some kind of new initiative this year. They keep talking about sort of CME 2.0, 2.1, et cetera, but they're quite slow. You know, the bureaucracy seems to be grinding them down. And by the time they come out with the lessons learned from their conference last year, for example, we're a year and a half on, there are other lessons that should have been learned in that time as well.
Yeah.
But you know, we're hopeful that their requirements and standards will evolve because, you know, ultimately, a lot of CME in Europe is also funded by pharma, I think much more than in the US. And pharma has expectations. They've got lessons. It's a globalized industry. A lot of it is driven from the US. And their sort of international experience is sort of driving practices in Europe just by virtue of the way they fund education. And the providers in Europe are sort of saying, well, hang on, if in order to get grant support for my activities, I need to be more interesting, innovative, etc. You know, so this is driving a change in Europe, probably the strongest way that I've seen recently.
Well, let's talk about funding a little bit, because one of the things, of course, that ACCME has done in the last few years, 2020, it published its revised standards for independence and integrity to really create a much clearer distinction between commercial interests and accredited CME. And yet you're saying that, you know, CME in Europe is driven much more by pharma, or certainly funded more by pharma than it is in the US. So can you talk a little bit about the funding structure in Europe?
Yeah, and this is a really thorny issue, I think. So if we look at CME in Europe as being a series of national activities, you know, and you go to the individual countries, I think the only country that has funded CME, grant-funded CME, according to ACCME expectations, I would say is France.
Okay.
In France, they have a system where there's absolute separation of the source of funding from the education that is created. It's a little complex. It's unique. Every country's system is unique.
Yeah.
But well, I think I'll leave it sort of like that. It's an interesting system. It's relatively new. But through historical reasons, there's a lot of suspicion of pharma activities. There was a huge scandal like 20, 25 years ago that went right up to the top of government involving a drug company. And they said, right, we're separating pharma from medical education in the country. And their CME system is completely separate. Mm. The next country could be Germany. Germany has very clear separation. However, the pharma company can be involved in certain aspects. In the implementation, not over control over content, or necessarily the planning, but they've drawn a line where the provider actually works with the pharma company in some way, or the pharma company can be involved, whether it's access to database of learners or maybe the actual implementation on the logistics side, this kind of thing that's forbidden under the ACCME system. And then once you go past those two countries, pharma gets much more involved. So, you know, throughout Scandinavia, it's seen as a 50-50 venture, practically.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then the UK, the NHS, you know, our National Health Service, stopped funding education for specialists over 10 years ago now on the basis that pharma would pick up the funding. Mm-hmm. But over the years, the Royal Colleges, we have sort of 24 Royal Colleges and faculties in the UK, they're responsible for accreditation of activities and for the maintenance of certification of physicians. Mm-hmm. And they, on the whole, have accredited activities directly controlled, initiated, presented by pharma There are some colleges where you've even got the drug company's name in the title of the activity. Mm. In fairness to the Royal College of Physicians, actually, they're part of the International Academy that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And I think it was last year, they said, no, absolutely not. Pharma cannot be involved. And they look a bit deeper. But on the whole, pharma is very involved in CPD in the UK to such a degree that global companies, internationally operating companies such as CME Learning, you know, we don't operate in the UK. It's just not compliant for us. It's far too close to pharma. And it's not just that it might jeopardize our ACCME accreditation status, but it could jeopardize our relationships with pharma companies because they need to be aware, you know, when they're funding something that's independent and arm's length, mm-hmm. they can't control it. And in the UK, especially this year, a pharma regulator is coming out with these rulings that's actually saying the pharma company should be controlling or approving or reviewing and approving activities that are what we would consider accredited CME.
I find that shocking. Actually, that's interesting. I had no idea. And I'm wondering, you know, from time to time in the US, you know, there are surveys and there's often kind of ongoing research to try and figure out what do learners think about the ways in which accredited education are designed, implemented, delivered, and so on. What's their experience of that? And do they detect, you know, bias and influence and the appearance of commercial interests? So I'm wondering what learners in Europe and the UK think about the relationship between pharma and the education that they have to do in order to, you know, maintain their certification and so on.
Yeah. No, that's interesting, actually. I hadn't thought of it like that. But yeah, looking at learners, I wonder if it's driven by some national characteristics. So let's say in France, there is that ongoing, just the French sort of approach to a lot of things in life. They expect pharma to be separate. That's fine. In Germany, they use the courts much more, so a bit more like the US. I wonder if the US system, actually, legal system, has some, you know, some German influence there. So they use, you know, courts for, you know, even just discussion, dialogue, arbitration, you know, much more than we do, let's say, in the UK. But in Germany, there have been providers that have said they've working in CME who've been actually closed down as a result of court action. So as in it's hit the public consciousness in some way, and it's deemed as unacceptable. Scandinavians, you know, they're Scandinavians. They're very open about everything. And I'm sure they're quite relaxed about the transparency and the way, you know, it's very transparent. So that's probably all right. But in the UK, as a Brit yourself, I think we sort of recognize that a lot of things can be sort of swept under the carpet. You know, we've always had to have other problems to focus on. And there have been some horrendous scandals in the UK that I think we get alarmed by. And usually at the beginning of the European CME Forum annual meeting, I do a little sort of half-hour annual review. It's about 15 minutes. Annual review, what's happened. And there are a couple of years where I've found practices. Yeah, there was one time there was a buying pharmacist in a hospital that worked part-time for the hospital, 3 or 4 days in the hospital, very influential, responsible for buying all the pharmaceutical medicinal products for a group of hospitals in a county, in a healthcare system in the UK, including working on the formulary committees, etc. Right. So he worked that 4 days a week. The fifth day a week, he worked directly for a pharmaceutical company.
Right, yeah.
And someone joined the dots, and it wasn't just the influence over what drugs were on the formulary of that healthcare system.
Which would be enough.
But it was all the spa visits to Baden-Baden. I remember there was that. And all the sort of the backhand was involved. And this erupted, and it was in the first week of August. But within a week, so it's main holiday season, as in summer holidays. Mm. But within a week, that story just fizzled out. Mm. And it was never to be spoken of again. And it's opportunities like this where someone, maybe in the Royal Colleges, should say, hang on, there's something not quite right here. Let's look at our practices and procedures and update them. So, and I feel that generally the accreditors in Europe are a little bit slow with keeping up with everyday developments in society, mm-hmm. but the UK especially so. You know, the implementation of the Bribery Act, So what I think in the US is seen as the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, you know, that's very strong in Europe. It's as though that's just washed through unnoticed. In the UK especially, yeah.
Yeah, I do find it strange that the Royal Colleges don't have a more distanced position on some of the issues that you've been talking about there, particularly when you look at the history of medicine and the way that the Royal Colleges really kind of worked hard to, as gatekeepers, to kind of keep everybody out of the business of medicine and, you know, medical practice. So maybe that's for another podcast. I do want to focus a little bit on CME Forum and the Journal of CME, because both of those entities obviously are kind of key stakeholders and players in shaping the conversation around CME in Europe. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of the work that both of these entities are doing to really promote CME in Europe in, you know, in terms of independence and integrity and some of the standards that you've been talking about.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we've been very lucky over the years. So it's now, in its 16th iteration, that we have really good representation from each of the stakeholder groups. And they keep coming back as well. I think they value the openness of the discussion that can take place. Over the years, we've had each group actually contributing something and actually using the meeting as a testbed for ideas. Mm. So actually attending the meeting, you feel as though you're in the middle of an evolving discussion. You know, when the IACME came out with their new standards for e-learning, or were the first standards for e-learning, they revised a lot of them. It was one of the London meetings. So we had the Secretary General who asked for half an hour to present the new standards to the group before they were going to be launched 2 months later.
Oh, interesting.
And he presented it and asked for feedback. We had keypads in the room. And we started saying, well, hang on, that won't work. That won't work. Gave direct feedback. And he said, actually, we shouldn't be launching it here. And he took it back to the drawing board and it was launched a year later. Mm. So that was, but it was really interesting to hear the accreditor there actually talking about the thought process within their organization and how they thought that the standards would be implemented with a room full of people who would be implementing those standards and funding those activities, as well as other accreditors. So that's interesting. But over the years, I think we've seen a lot of discussion from, the accreditor side. The International Academy have been sharing their work with the group, which is hugely valuable. Mm-hmm. The medical societies have been coming together. So the Biomed Alliance, which is like an alliance of 50 or so of the leading European medical societies, a part of the Biomed Alliance, and they are now discussing their collective approach to CME at the European CME Forum. So this is really valuable because they were all operating their own silos, as individual specialty-led groups. Pharma, you know, for years as a organizer of this meeting, you know, would come to the meeting. They wouldn't really talk to each other. There's that sort of idea that they're all competitors, or there's collusion that goes on. Mm-hmm. But we were there, so supporting the work of the International Pharmaceutical Alliance, the CME. So like there was a US group, the PACME group, which has now become, they've been renamed as something else, but to IPACME. So it's usually the international, the grant offices, the heads of these, the grant offices got together and started talking about how CME should be funded internationally. And for a number of years, they were discussing their ideas at the European CME Forum meeting. FPIA got involved as well, you know, a pan-European regulator for the pharmaceutical industry. And it took like 6, 7, 8 years, and there were new standards that were introduced to the newest FPIA code of practice. So what the pharmaceutical industry now is following in Europe is really, I like to say, is actually the result of 7 years of discussion at European CME Forum that they could, the group of pharma could take away and actually, through understanding the CME environment, actually come up with a way of funding education at arm's length in Europe. And on the provider side, we've also got the Good CME Practice Group, where there are 13 or 14 now organizations, European providers, that can, again, get together to talk about the challenges that they experience as a group. So we have these sort of like four silos, maybe, that talk to within themselves. We have the intra-silo discussion, but then coming together as European CME Forum, it is really valuable to see how everyone interacts and just how far people go and test our own assumptions of, oh, that's how that group works. Mm-hmm. Speaking to that group and them saying, well, actually, we thought you were approaching it a different way. And there is a sense of progress in the discussion. So this is great. So we're doing our 16th annual meeting is in The Hague on the basis that someone has to be sent there.
Oops.
we're going there. And no, it's just a fantastic venue. It's only 20 minutes from Schiphol Airport. We just wanted to get away from Amsterdam. So it's the same distance as downtown Amsterdam. Mm. In the place where we get together for 3 days to discuss this. And there will be a lot of talk about independence integrity, actually, this year, because it's become hugely important, exactly on the topics that we've been talking about, for the accreditors to be aware of the compliance landscape in Europe and for providers and the international community, the global community. We have quite a few people from the US who come to the meeting. The ACCME have been great supporters over the year, the Royal College in Canada, many providers in the US, and of course, the heads of the grant offices come and are involved in some way. Sorry, not all of them. Sorry, there's always good representation so that we can understand their perspective. And of course, this is in addition to the usual European attendees. But we'll start the meeting actually with joining things up with JECME. Our Journal of CME. So originally that was called the Journal of European CME. But after a few years, we realized that the papers that were coming in were not majority European. And also our readership is global.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So last year, we just dropped the word European. Of course, it takes some time. It's a PubMed indexed journal. And we've rebranded it now as the Journal of CME. Mm-hmm. And for the past few years now, we've been running a special issue, we call it a special collection. And the first one was on outcomes. Mm-hmm. And Don Moore was the guest editor for that with our own editor-in-chief, Robin Stevenson. And this worked really well because it focused people's minds on a single topic and people would submit their articles on that. And this year's topic, we're talking about expanding the voices in CME CPD.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and it's something that we're trying to foster in Europe, is this thinking outside the box. How can we be more imaginative in our education? And the journal itself there is really to promote discussion and promote the academic pursuit of CME, especially in Europe. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to emulate what was going on in North America. Of course, we have quite a few submissions from the US and Canada anyway, which is fantastic. But just to have that for us as the European CME Forum to promote this discussion and to point out to people there's interprofessional education. Mm-hmm. The patient voice is important in medical education. Big data plays a huge part. How do we use all these different sources, other voices? Mm-hmm. Maybe people, especially the interprofessional side. Actually, I'm not going to go into it because I'll have to read off a list of like 20 things from the thing. So if people could come to the website, jcme.org, and follow the links to the special collection, maybe some of the listeners here could be inspired to write something. It doesn't have to be a huge piece of work, as long as it's sort of sharing experiences that can help the international CME environment. The journal will consider a whole host of submissions for that. And what we'll do in the annual meeting in November, the guest editor, who's Lisa Sullivan from Australia.
Okay. Yeah, I know Lisa. Mm-hmm. I know who she is.
Great. So she's doing it really energetically, reaching out to people all over the world to share their experiences with the journal. And she and her editorial team will select a number of papers, invite the authors to the European CME Forum at the meeting to actually just do a deeper dive in some of these works or the themes that come out. The submissions have only started trickling in now.
Yeah.
So Lisa will lead that. And the whole main thing about the meeting, the journal, is to foster conversation. The meeting is very interactive. We try and make faculty as learner as faculty.
Mm.
So there's lots of discussion from the floor and hopefully people find it good fun as well.
Yeah, I'm really, sorry to be missing the meeting this year, and it's certainly on my horizon for other years. And you are talking about a lot of different acronyms and a lot of different organizations. So I'll make sure that there are links in the show notes for people to kind of follow those breadcrumbs. But in the last few minutes that we have left, you know, you talked about the journal focusing on expanding voices, and you've talked about content a couple of times and that process of content creation. So can we just touch on that a little bit in terms of, you know, who are the key players in creating content in the European and in the UK setting? Because when we talk about expanding voices, sometimes there are players in that process who are a little less visible than others, you know, in terms of getting their fingers dirty with the text and the images and the various interactive components that go into learning activities.
Yeah, and we probably have a huge spectrum of sort of involvement of people and the different professions even that are involved. Because quite a bit of, let's say, one end of the spectrum, let's say which is the less compliant end of the spectrum. Let's start there. We might have a lot of the CME actually comes from the medical communications background.
Yeah.
There are medcoms agencies that are being asked by their, let's say, European or national pharma companies saying, we will fund CME in the loosest sense of the word if you develop this. So we could even have promotional writers writing all the content, and the projects can be, unfortunately, developed like a medcoms project, you know, under the control of the promotional side.
Mm.
But the writers, the editorial skills involved there are far removed from, let's say, quite frankly, the kind of work that you do, Alex, and you know, writers in the US working within the CME scope. It's a different skill set because they are usually writing to order, and they're trying to untrain themselves from the promotional messages that they've been trained to write through. And let's go to the other end of the spectrum. There are quite a few providers who leave all the writing and content development to the faculty themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of scratching under the surface, I think it's a lot because the actual companies involved who do that don't have the internal competencies actually to get involved in that educational design and or even guiding faculty of how to go. So they're left to sort of run free with doing things their way. And that's also far removed, especially if it's grant-funded education, where you say, we've done this needs assessment,
sure,
we'll be addressing the following learning objectives. And meanwhile, you get three faculty members together who are passionate about something completely unrelated. Say, don't worry, we'll sort out a good event, activity or whatever. And I think the provider is then quite shocked by the output.
And they bring along their 150 slide deck with them.
Yeah, just say, yeah, say, relax, don't worry, I can speak really fast.
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah, and then there is that chunk in the middle. So let's say the good CME practice kind of things that is going on in Europe, where we do have good quality. So the writers, the editorial competencies now are increasing in Europe. They're starting to. They nowhere near the maturity as in the US. That's now, yeah. So on the educational design side, I think that's probably been driven, especially during the pandemic, when people have been analyzing their own data, seeing the learner engagement. So much more education was done online. And it's quite difficult to sit back saying, well, we had a room full of 400 people and we had 400 chairs. Didn't we do well?
Yeah.
Now actually sort of looking at things saying, oh, damn, people are coming into our online, our enduring education or whatever, and dropping out after 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Looking at the first, why is that? How can we keep them in? And then just looking at the relevance of the education and all those sort of quality issues around keeping learners. So I think that's helped to drive standards up. And then, you know, of course, related to that is that outcomes piece of the pie. Yeah.
Piece of the pie.
Is that the right phrase? Piece of the cake.
We'll go with it.
And this has been very new for a lot of providers in Europe. And the grantors are asking to see data. And now, and we're seeing it as a journal as well. You know, the submissions to JECME from European organizations is increasing. So there is now a higher awareness in Europe that people need these competencies and the organizations themselves. So it's a bit of a mishmash, but I think we're going in the right direction. And I'm hoping I've given you sort of the answer to the question that you asked. Is this what you're sort of looking for? I feel like it's a whistle-stop tour of the failings and some successes in Europe.
Strengths and weaknesses. And I think that it is a whistle-stop tour. And I would love to suggest part two at some point in the future, because I think there's a lot of other things that we can dig into for sure. And I love listening to you and have a lot more questions. But in the interest of time, I'm going to sort of wrap up our conversation here. But I do have one final question for you, which is, what is one takeaway message that you would like listeners of Right Medicine to hear? And the audience is surprisingly global. You know, it's heavily concentrated in North America, but there are listeners in Europe and various other parts of the world. So one takeaway about CME in Europe and the UK, that maybe that's two takeaways. I don't want to make it difficult.
Yeah. I think that's really tough, Alex. But I think come join the discussion. Take part in the discussion.
Love that.
Yeah. And as a first step, to look at the Journal of CME, whether it's just to see what other people have written, but submit something, share your experiences. And that goes right back to why I started up European CME Forum in the first place, was those questions, usually from US colleagues that came across, you know, when I was turning up to the Alliance meeting and things. Mm. Oh, you come from Europe. How big is it? How big is CME? How big is Europe? How big is CME? Who's involved?
It could be that question too.
Yeah. But there was just nothing out there in the public domain. Mm-hmm. And it's only really through so many people joining the discussion that we've created this sort of sense of community where we're actually learning from each other. And so please come to the journal and ideally to the meeting. But yeah, join the discussion.
I love that invitation to connect and to see European CME as, you know, a sister set of organizations, an ally in the kind of broader CME enterprise. So thank you for sharing that and for sharing all your insights and wisdom with listeners of Right Medicine, Eugene Pozniak, man of many hats, and of course, many, many talents. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Alex. Take care.
You too.
If you're like me and see yourself as a lifelong learner who loves connection with other CME professionals, come and check out what Right Medicine offers in terms of community and courses. And I'd love to hear from you what you're interested in learning more about on the podcast. And if you like the podcast or a particular episode, consider writing a review on Apple Podcasts or share with your colleagues and peers. There's a link in the show notes to help you do all of these things. See you next time.